The Australian Queer Archives in Melbourne contain an extraordinary little item. A tiny glass vial with a black plastic lid, scarcely bigger than a thimble. The glass vial contains something that looks like burnt wood in it. Taped to it is a small stiff card in a colour approximating puce yellow. A legend printed on that card in black ink proclaims the following: Ashes of the Barracks from the Great Folsom Fire, July 1981. A sacred relic salvaged by the sisters from the site of the barracks bathhouse, a San Francisco shrine dedicated to perpetual indulgence in years past, destroyed by fire, July 1981. I am Miles Pattenden from the University of Oxford, and I am here with my colleague Dr. Michael Barbazar from the Australian Catholic University. This podcast tells the story of our research into that vial of ashes, how they came to be, what purpose they served, and what intellectual genealogies lie behind them. Our object story begins, in one sense, in the Castro, San Francisco's queer neighbourhood, with an activist group, the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence, at the end of the 1970s. In another sense, however, it began hundreds of years earlier, in the material culture and spirituality of medieval Christianity in the Latin West. Gay relics, as we term these ashes, and other similar items, form an important component within the understudied phenomenon of queer medievalism. Medievalism, the creative interpretation or recreation of the European Middle Ages, as Louise Darsan has defined it, has been a major field of research for medievalists, who increasingly interrogate the eclectic mix of pasts it brings together in the present. Queer medievalism, on the other hand, is the subfield of medieval studies associated with members of the LGBTIQI plus community. Many will be familiar with medievalists who queer texts and locate alterity in them. That is not our enterprise here. Rather, we're engaged in an historical study for the 20th century of those who did the queering. The fundamental question in our research has been why queer activists, at various times, but here in particular in the early 1980s, have found neglected attributes of pre-modern Catholicism so useful for discussions of gay male sex. A utility that seems somewhat paradoxical, given pre-modern Christianity's association with the origins of European homophobia, as well as its perceived backwardness. The argument we set out here is that through their making of relics such as the barracks ashes, the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence used a language of sacrality to construe and to commemorate the role played by sex in the creation of contemporary gay male communities. Moreover, this was an idea that translated globally, travelling along with the wider currents of queer culture from San Francisco to Sydney, Australia. The Sisters' amateur, activist queer medievalism reimagined apparently sordid and unseemly origins of contemporary queer community in a positive way. It co-opted the medieval language of relics to render the places and experience of gay men as holy, a holiness that could be both expressed and defended. Overcoming barriers of shame felt even by some sisters themselves, this language of the sacred allowed the unspeakable to be spoken. In a central paradox, the very religious heritage of pre-modern Christianity, which had rendered sodomy and the homoeroticism often associated with it into an unspeakable sin, became the vehicle to assert and preserve queer identity. This is the sister's story.
Gay men have tried to save and preserve the memory of queer spaces for a very long time. Their actions form part of a wider and understandable phenomenon driven by our very human desire to remember what matters to us and what has been formative and central in our lives. H. Montgomery Hyde, a pioneering campaigner for the decriminalization of homosexuality in Britain in the mid-20th century, once related a story, it's probably apocryphal, of how a wealthy American acted on the impulse to purchase a London public toilet where he had enjoyed sex with other men during the Second World War. He supposedly re-erected it on the grounds of his massive estate outside of New York. The relics of the barracks bathhouse began similarly, in the affection of San Francisco's gay men for a well-known location on Folsom Street's Miracle Mile of gay bars and clubs. San Francisco's gay community had flourished during the 70s, and the Barracks had become a legendary part of it since its opening in 1972. It was part of the community and a focus of activity during early pride parades. However, the Barracks burned to the ground on the 10th of July, 1981. This, like an earlier fire which had forced the venue to close but hadn't destroyed the building in 1976, seemed to be the result of arson. The local gay and lesbian community perceived both events as part of an anti-gay hate crime spree, or at least part of bad urban policy that left gay businesses in unsafe buildings. And leaders such as Harvey Milk began to organize a concerted response. The story of the bathhouse itself might have ended there, except for a second related phenomenon, the foundation of the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence in 1979. The Sisters, now a global order of queer and trans nuns, were the brainchild of a few very brave individuals. On a slow day, one pioneering activist from Iowa, Kenneth Bunch, turned to another, Fred Brungard, and showed him a set of defunct habits from a Cedar Rapids convent which had been preserved as theater costumes. "I'm bored," he said. "Let's throw them on and go out and just terrorize the town." These two men, known in habit by their sister names, as Sister Vicious Power Hungry Bitch, often called Vish, and Sister Missionary Position, often called Mish, had gathered enough followers around them, soon, to call themselves an order. A third sister also manifested on the first day, Sister Solicitation, who designed costumes and, of course, was named Solicitation because she became in charge of recruitment. Soon another sister, Mary Media, took on communications roles, and a fifth, Bill Graham, played the part of the Reverend Mother. All of these men were keenly and highly educated, and brought with them to their activism not only that education, but a wicked sense of satire. The Barracks ashes were born of this, when Mish suggested they start collecting the dust and debris from the burned-out venue and putting it in little glass bottles. These little glass bottles were also a bit of a joke because they were the same ones used in the distribution of cocaine. Mish claimed not to be aware of that at the moment. Mish drew on this practice as a former Catholic seminarian. He'd been forced to leave the church on account of his sexuality, but he took all of the lessons and experiences he'd had with him. Along with his fellow sisters, he was soon distributing the vials of the ashes to the local queer community. They originally came with a card that had an absolution written on it that had been designed by another sister called Sleaze du Jour, which announced its bearer's renouncement of the guilt that he had felt because of devotion to, quote, the pleasures of this world. According to the card's rubric, the bearer had dropped his load, specifically of guilt, along with a suggestively low donation into a sister's lap to be expiated by their good works under the eyes of an always forgiving goddess. The card ends with a famous quotation attributed to Johann Tetzel, whose 16th century sale of indulgences supposedly inspired Martin Luther and the Protestant Reformation. "The money no sooner clinks in the can than another soul to heaven flies." The sisters used the proceeds from selling these ashes to finance their famous Playfair Safe Sex pamphlet of 1982. This pamphlet, the first of its kind in the world, was a community-led response to the spread of sexually transmitted infections and what was at that time called the new gay cancer, which we now know as HIV/AIDS. Various sisters of particular expertise came together in this operation. Sisters who were registered nurses, such as Florence Nightmare and Rosurrection, wrote the content of the pamphlet, and sisters with seminary backgrounds like Mish raised the funds to pay for it through the sale of the ash relics, among some other things. On Christmas Eve in 1981, three sisters, Vish, Mish, and Pius, were selling the Barracks relics, along with some of their other fundraising items, and there was a near riot after San Francisco police attempted to arrest Sister Pius, who was visiting from out of town and didn't have an ID on her. The sisters were running a confessional on the street with relics, postcards, and t-shirts, which the police cited as peddling without a permit. Mish recognized the citation, though, as part of a long-term campaign of harassment that interfered with what they termed their freedom of religion and their sincere attempt to respond to their community's spiritual needs. Using impeccable logic from the history of Catholicism, which reconceived the commodification and theft of relics as pious exchanges, Mish explained that relics cannot be sold as such. To quote an article from the gay press that came out a couple days later, They don't peddle, Sister Missionary Position stated. We spread joy. We tell people to give up their guilt. In their ministry, they collect donations. As part of their relics ministry, they dispense holy t-shirts, holy postcards, and holy ashes from the Folsom Street fire. The giving and the getting happen at exactly the same time. This the sisters attribute to a marvelous condition manifesting their enormous power of mutual love. They don't sell anything. The charges against Mish and the other sisters were eventually dropped.
If the sisters' gay relics of the Barracks bathhouse in San Francisco had been the only example of their practice, then that would be interesting enough, a subject worthy of a research paper for sure. Yet not long after the relics appeared in San Francisco, they were also on the move, translated to Sydney, Australia. The immediate context for this was the foundation of an Australian chapter of the Order of Perpetual Indulgence, the third after San Francisco and a house in Toronto, Canada. That connection between the Western United States and the Eastern Australian seaboard itself reflected a long history that had emerged through the respective gold rushes of both places in the late 1840s and 1850s, and had been sustained after World War II, especially in gay male circles, through cable operators and the merchant marine. Both founding Australian sisters, Gary Schliemann, known as Sister May Call of the Wild West, and Fabian Lo Schiavo, known as Mother Inferior, visited San Francisco in the early 1980s. It was Lo Schiavo who brought two vials of the Barracks ashes and several copies of the Playfair pamphlet Down Under. Like Sister Mish in San Francisco, Lo Schiavo was a former Catholic. As a teenager, he had entered the noviciate of the Premonstratensians, a venerable medieval order of monks, and had been sent away to Green Bay, Wisconsin, to complete his training. Like Sister Mish, he had left the Catholic Church because it was unable to accommodate his desire to have a sexuality. His fledgling group of Australian gay male nuns had begun manifesting in 1981, but by 1983 they were thinking proactively about relics, community, and memory. The Australian sisters went beyond the original American practice of preserving pieces of a destroyed sex venue by developing something far-sighted and unique, a series of relic exhibitions, which they called reliquaries. These displays offered contemporary social commentary through their collection and arrangement of objects. The first such gay reliquary took place in 1983 during the annual Conference of Lesbians and Homosexual Men in Melbourne. It was comprised of a series of rooms containing various objects of perceived significance to contemporary gay men in Australia. While planning for it, the reliquary's organiser, Sister Mary Third Secret of Fatima, met with resistance from the conference conveners. A little dubious as to the political correctness of this, the organisers were eager to avoid being seen to mock religion. The idea went ahead anyway, despite their reservations. Third Secret asked the other sisters at their chapter meeting to, quote, ransack their personal shrines for suitable relics, such as pieces of the true cross, bits of the leftover fishes and loaves, nose rings from the papal bull, feathers from angels' wings, the demand from the life insurance company for their money back after Lazarus was risen from the dead, etc. A minute about the subsequent reliquary from 1985 contains further such ideas for exhibits, such as curdled virgin's milk, a test of faith machine, and a waste paper basket for St. Paul. Sister Third Secret took the Gay Waves radio presenter Greg Redding through a tour of the completed reliquary from 1983, highlighting its many subversive and campy pieces. A recording has been preserved. The two men note the busts of the three wise men, Hua Kuofeng and Saints Marx and Engels, the envelope for Paul's letter to the Corinthians, and a packet of Camel cigarettes next to an absurdly large needle for the rich gays. Other exhibits were more biting, a set of tracts from the vehemently homophobic Chick Publications and the flag of its contemporary Australian distributor, the Salvation Army. The sisters maintained many of these objects as props for other manifestations. they staged a similar reliquary in Sydney above a gay bookshop on Oxford Street, which had emerged as the centre of gay community and commercial life in the city during Stonewall Week in June 1984 and again in 1985. In a later appearance on public access television, Lo Schiavo, manifesting as Mother Inferior, highlighted many of the same pieces, as well as a few additions, such as the sunglasses Mary had worn during the flight to Egypt. A further addition, of which Lo Schiavo seems to have been particularly proud, was the fragment of a tennis shoe worn by Saint Martina Navratilova, subsequently presented to Robin Tyler, the first out lesbian on US television, in 1988.
Sydney's Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence produced one further memorable relic, the centerpiece, actually, of our article written on this, which was directly related to the ashes of the barracks bathhouse. In 1984, they rescued the stainless steel urinal from a public toilet at the heart of Sydney's gay village that was being demolished by the city council. The toilet and the park around it had become a notorious gay beat. That's Australian for a place where men went to have anonymous sex with other men, which was perhaps why the council had resolved to remove and rebuild it. To the gay community, this beat was a public possession at the very center of their neighborhood. Members of the local gay community certainly regarded the toilet block's demolition as an unsubtle attempt to purge the area of gays. This was not least because it seemed part of a pattern. A similar toilet in Victoria Park had been demolished just before this, and others continued to be destroyed in subsequent years. The city's vice squad and liquor licensing authorities had recently launched a crackdown on the gay pubs and sex venues of Sydney's Golden Mile, which is Sydney's version of the Castro along Oxford Street. In the state of New South Wales, Australia, which is where Sydney is, gay sex was still illegal at this time. Decriminalization only happened in 1984, although still with a discriminatory age of consent that's different for men and having sex with men than for heterosexual couples. The crackdown on gay sex coincided with the beginning of the AIDS crisis in Australia, which, as in the United States, generated moral panic about homosexual promiscuity. In January 1983, and again a month later, Ernie Shepherd, the head of Sydney Police's vice squad, led what are now infamous raids on a well-known backroom club or sex-on-premises venue called Club 80. The community perceived these efforts as rooted in civic authorities' religious hostility to gays. Two activists, Lex Watson and Robert French, marched into Shepherd's office and handed him statutory declarations that listed all the sexual partners they had had over the past year, and they challenged him to prosecute them. Their actions were part of a wider campaign in the city for gay law reform. Shepherd declined to act against the activists. But part of the issue in 1983 was that the raids stood outside of the normal pattern of such activities. Police harassment wasn't new to the Sydney scene, but normally the owners of bars that were to be raided were tipped off just in time for their patrons to escape. By contrast, 27 men faced criminal charges after the Club 80 raids because there was no customary tip-off. The sisters exorcised Club 80 following the raid on it, restoring its ownership to the gay community. But the campaign against the queer community continued. It was in this context that two sisters parked their truck on Darlinghurst Street between the shattered toilet's ruin and the rough-cut stone walls of the neighboring Darlinghurst jail called by the gay community the Wailing Walls. Their account of the rescue adopt a very particular language. Having witnessed the desecration of the park's special wedding chapel, one of the most sacred sites in the Southern Hemisphere, the sisters rallied their order. They had come to the ruined shrine early in the morning. They took relics from a shrine, which were of each of its species, that's tiles, bricks, woodwork, stucco, and of course the great steel altarpiece. This altar was the focus, and they removed it in its battered and soiled entirety because it had been the object of intense veneration by thousands of gay men over many years. The preservation of these pieces, they said, would keep alive the love and the power invested in the shrine through the pilgrimages of so many of the faithful. The chapel, as a pilgrimage site, had hosted countless acts of love and devotion inside its walls, and the destruction of those walls saddened the thousands still joined together by that numinous power. A report in the Sydney Star Observer, a local gay newspaper, offered the first report of their claim to responsibility. Accompanied by a photograph of Sister May Call of the Wild West, that's Gary Schliemann, making use of the urinal in earlier days, it included information about what had been taken and transmitted the sisters' collective thanks to other parties that had helped them. It also proclaimed the sisters' intention to display the urinal relic for the gay faithful during the following year's Mardi Gras parade, which is like Sydney Gay Pride. Till then, rest assured that your sisters have effectively intervened to save our most precious relics, and they are safely preserved for the benefit of our community, it continued. It also set a time and a date for the mourning rites, identified here using a particularly obscure medieval term, the mind, as Mother Inferior, Lo Schiavo, intimated this during that mourning ceremony. The toilet had symbolized a spirit of freedom, solidarity, and resourcefulness in a world that is too often hostile, discriminatory, and lonely. The sisters did indeed display the urinal at the Mardi Gras parade in 1985, and again at other events. They cut little pieces from it and distributed them around the community, just as San Francisco sisters had done with the ashes of the Barracks bathhouse 3 or 4 years before.
A major line of inquiry in our research on the gay relics of San Francisco and Sydney has been, why reclaim and venerate them at all? An Australian Broadcasting Corporation documentary, Australia's New Golden City of the Gays, produced in 1982, had drawn public attention to sites of anonymous sexual encounter, preferring a negative and moralising commentary as it did so. The presenter looks to camera before pronouncing how public sex is, quote, both incredibly promiscuous and incredibly sordid. He implies that gay men had better stop doing it if they ever want to be accepted by society's mainstream. In fact, many gay men in the community were also already self-censoring in this regard. An article in Sydney's gay newspaper, The Star Observer, from May 1984, reminded them that public sex would still be subject to prosecution even after the then-proposed decriminalisation took effect. Yet the ABC's documentary also included a riposte to the presenter from Bob Hay, a gay Sydney psychologist and former secretary of the Gay Counselling Service. Hay said, "A friend of mine who is very aware of the significance public toilets have to many gays in the early stages of coming out, a man who came from the country and had no other source of contact, says that we should claim these places as sacred sites." Hay's comment addressed a fundamental truth that many at the time found unpalatable. Public sex was then axiomatic to gay identity in Australia and indeed elsewhere. If this sex was not in beats or tea rooms, then it was in bars, backrooms, or bathhouses like the Barracks. An American history of those gay bathhouses, also published in 1984, observes how such places represented, quote, a major success in a century-long struggle to overcome isolation and to develop a sense of community and pride in their sexuality. These were safe zones in which men could express affection for other men in full view. Perhaps most importantly, many men, quote, learned to enjoy having sex with and loving other gay men in such spaces. Clive Moore has argued something similar when discussing Queensland in the 1990s. Quote, beats, that is the public spaces used for sexual encounter, are integral to the sexual web binding together both closeted and uncloseted homosexual men. Cutting across all ages, classes, and races, they function as communal possessions of local gay societies and as a focus for local gay subcultures. The emergent field of queer geography is seeking to explore how people's identities are in part constructed through the spatial locations they inhabit and frequent. It posits that claims to space involve overlapping, intersectional identities from which many of our contemporary categories of queer identity have emerged. Sociological studies of the impact of sex venues on their patrons' lives also emphasise their role as powerful ritual spaces for liminal experiences that have potential to transform their patrons. As Ira Tattleman has argued, quote, spaces of homosexual encounter helped gay men accept their difference from society, whilst creating a place for themselves in society. This self-discovery is an important part of the development of an identity. Regular social norms did not necessarily apply in such spaces, leaving space for developing gay cultures to achieve a sense of collective worth through spatial mastery. Like secular temples, they inculcated something spiritual and sacred. The map of the gay ghetto, which the Gay Counselling Service provided for the Sydney Gay Guide 1983, no doubt influenced by Hay, labels the toilet block the sisters raided in a similar fashion. It is called a sacred site. Hay's seemingly absurd suggestion in the ABC documentary in fact captures almost exactly the program that the sisters later carried out.
Where then was the medievalism in all of this? At one level, it lies in the sisters' subversive challenge to civic authorities in the cities where they manifested, turning these authorities' disgust itself into a sacrality around which the besieged queer community could cohere. This was, in essence, the same act of inversion which Peter Brown famously saw in the Christian cult of the saints in late antiquity. For early Christians, places of shame associated with execution and the bodies of their martyred dead became sacred hearts of new communities. For San Francisco and Sydney's sisters in the gay Holy Lands of the Castro and Darlinghurst, places of bodily shame and pollution caused by bodies engaged in queer sex became a source of holy relics, preserving the place's power as a space of self-formation and resistance against heteronormative expectations. Medieval historians will also recognize the sisters' rescue of the ashes from the barracks fire and the urinal from the Sydney Park toilets as an example of synecdoche, a concept at the heart of medieval relic culture. The logic of synecdoche is that the entire presence of something sacred is contained in just a little bit fragment of it. Thus, a piece of a saint's broken body holds the saint's whole person, just as the small communion wafer of the Eucharist conveys Christ's entire presence to the faithful. Synecdoche was intimately tied to Christian notions of resurrection and rebirth. For early Christians, the defilement of death's corruption was temporary. Like seeds, saints' withered bones would sprout to life again, and the saints' continued vital presence promised new communities for the living. As they were taken to different places, new Christian communities could grow around the relics as the fragmented part somehow carried with it the spirit of the whole. A fragmented saint would return to life at the resurrection, and the bits of shattered bone and golden reliquaries would one day stitch back together into a person. At the time of HIV/AIDS, and in an age of redevelopment that displaced urban communities, queer relics make similar promises of rebirth as survival after apparent death and destruction.
The very spontaneity of the sisters' acquisition of their various relics itself repeated a central element of another medieval genre, furto sacra, or holy theft, and the narratives recounting the movement, translaciones or translations of relics from place to place. These narratives often represented the urge to secure a relic as a sudden and divine inspiration. Following this model, the acquisition of relics was not a calculated act of theft or desecration, but rather the will of the commemorated saint. Likewise, that a relic was in danger of desecration, as the demolished Sydney toilet was, or had actually been desecrated, as the barracks bathhouse had been, was a familiar legitimizing circumstance. The collectors of these relics were thus the pious servants of the person or thing commemorated, rather than savvy commodifiers. Sisters acquired their understanding of these ideas from their Catholic backgrounds and educations. Lo Schiavo in Sydney, for instance, related an anecdote which could be seen as crucial to the formation of his own relic theory. Quote, "I remember Mum coming and saying that they had handed out the relic of St. Anthony of Padua's tongue at our local church in Marsfield, because it was St. Anthony of Padua, St. Anthony's parish. And I said, 'What did they do with it, Mum?' 'They just passed it, and passed it from person to person, and you could kiss it if you wanted to, but I passed on because it was so holy.' St. Anthony's tongue could not be touched. Like the body of the risen Christ in John 20:17, it was too sacred." Yet other sisters acquired a more intellectual interest in such artefacts. Ken Davis, Sydney's sister Third Secret, for instance, visited the superannuated relics at the Sacré-Cœur in Montmartre, where the apparent lack of interest in them by everybody else sparked his own curiosity. He also cites a popular Catholic book, Joan Carol Cruise's The Incorruptibles from 1977, as a key inspiration. Cruise, in all seriousness, piously catalogues 102 saints whose corpses, now maintained as relics, supposedly do not decay, even though, in entry after entry, she admits that the corpse is now a mummy or a wax figure, but had once been a miraculous preservation. Recognising Cruise's relic veneration as kitsch, Davis and his fellow sisters spoke back to it through camp, a sensibility that was familiar to 20th century queer communities the world over. Camp was a rediscovery of history's waste, in the words of Andrew Ross. It represented an irreverent tradition that retrieved and revived not only that which had been excluded from the serious high cultural tradition, but also the more unsalvageable material that has been picked over and found wanting by the purveyors of the antique. This atavistic property has often made camp a powerful resource for expression of queer identity. In the early 1980s, relics were an ideal target for transformation into camp instruments of queer self-fashioning. As Lo Schiavo remembered, as church-going Catholics, we were, quote, all embarrassed by all this medievalism. Relics reflected the overlapping fields of the personal identification the sisters as gay men experienced between their bodies, their spaces, and their favourite fragments of culture. They were useful anachronisms. The whole idea of the sisters themselves, in fact, fits this paradigm. Their original outfits were items the Catholic Church had officially dispensed with after the Second Vatican Council in 1965. The founding sisters' use of them therefore marked them out not only as unofficial nuns, but as creatures out of time. As non-celibate male nuns, they were simultaneously both respectable and obscene. They reminded audiences of the enduring power of the binary choice historically forced on women, sex or religious vocation, and they enacted pieces of both outcomes.
The sisters' creation of gay relics in the 1980s was an historical episode in the history of medievalism and in queer history that still matters today. One reason for this is because of the formative role that it played in an ongoing conversation about queer identities and their relationships to wider historical culture. As Ken Davis, that's Sister Third Secret, remembers, amidst the superabundance of camp and kitsch, which the reliquaries and the stainless steel centerpiece represented, men often from traditional religious backgrounds would approach the sisters, asking for absolution, to confess, and to process their conflicted feelings. By sanctifying anti-gay objects alongside campy, kitschy parodies or broken bits of buildings, the sisters drew attention to the essential artifice of religious and theological systems, which they now replicated in subversive ways. Such subversive repetition, to invoke Judith Butler's celebrated phrase, relies on exaggeration, parody, and juxtaposition, but at the same time, it still meets the very human needs which such systems must satisfy and actually, indeed, are developed to serve. Beyond that, however, the sisters' fundamental insight in creating relics was to recognize that the sex venue and the gay men who patronized it represented each other. Cynic Doki rendered an assault on gay spaces a parallel assault upon gay bodies. The parallel wasn't lost either on the opponents of queer communities, nor on the members of these communities themselves, either in Sydney or San Francisco. All of this was especially the case during the early 80s, when in the United States, a bit less in Australia, the AIDS crisis emboldened authorities to destroy spaces associated with a dangerous gay sexuality, which they saw as synonymous with the personhood of dangerous gays, who of course were now identified with a modern plague. This process, so destructive in the past, hasn't really ended. Indeed, Jennifer Evans has described contemporary queer history's problem with memory at some length in her book. As some parts of the queer community have assimilated into mainstream society, types of individuals and experiences that are particularly unpalatable to that society's norms and values have been cut out of the most common narratives of queer history. This process amounts to a social organization of forgetting, tied to the normalization of certain types of queer citizenship, and certain types only. The sisters' relics testify against this amnesia, recalling the mix of historicity and desire that has often served as an engine of queer sociability. As recently as 2018, Another sister in Perth, Western Australia, that's the other side of the continent, decided to donate to the State Museum another gay relic. In this case, a door with a glory hole in the middle of it from another local restroom that was well known to Perth's gay community. The museum recognized the door as an artifact of cultural importance, but received a sharp rebuke from a prominent local politician for doing it. This politician, Tony Kristevic, echoed almost exactly the presenter on the ABC documentary about Sydney's gay life from 40 years before. The door, he said, was, quote, too tacky to display. For it represented the illegal act of public sex, which was a scourge for Western Australians just trying to use public facilities. Quote, I'm not sure it is a suitable exhibit to be seen by school children who will flock to the new Western Australian Museum when it is completed. The invocation of children here is particularly worth noting in light of the queer theorist Lee Eidelman's argument that all political philosophy is framed in terms of an imagined future, which projects innocence and virtue onto an imagined next generation. In such a cultural paradigm, reproductive sex, which is productive, should be privileged over non-reproductive sex, just a form of economic consumption. Gay sex, in this formula, can only ever be a source of wastage, futility, deviance, and ultimately shame. Our final observation, then, is if bathhouse ashes, urinal troughs, and the anonymous sex facilitated through them are inappropriate things to remember, if the persecution of gay men is not valued in the same way as the persecution of other minority groups when curating public memory, then queer communities themselves also have to somehow remain inappropriate, tacky, and imperfectly integrated into the larger body of the nation's history. This matters for all of us as we face a difficult time with the resources of the past to guide us. Until we can tell stories about sex without blushing, until we can do that without recourse to an obscure, medievalizing language of the sacred as the only means for legitimizing this, then the work of the sisters' activism is still incomplete. Like the remnants of the saints which inspired them, the histories of the sisters' relics point to unrequited yearnings and to promises awaiting fulfillment.
This has been an episode of The Multicultural Middle Ages, an anthology-style podcast series sponsored by the Medieval Academy of America. Season 4 was produced by Will Beattie, Jonathan Correa-Reyes, Reed O'Mara, Logan Quigley, and me, Lauren Lee, with music by Anna O'Connell. For more information on the MMA podcast, follow the links in the episode description and consider subscribing to keep up with the latest episodes. Thanks for listening.